step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about The Mandrake by Niccolo Machiavelli. Yes, that's Machiavelli. He also, it turns out, wrote plays, comedies, in fact. And here today joining me to talk all about the comedy of Machiavelli is Stelios. Thank you for joining me, sir.
You're welcome. I'm really looking forward to it. I have to say that I hadn't read the play. And you suggested us to do it, and I said yes.
Yes, you did.
And I really enjoyed it.
It's
great, really
funny. Isn't it? Well, yes. It's. I find that it's a facet of Machiavelli that is really underappreciated. Obviously, you know, not saying that the stuff that he's most well known for, the Discourses and The Prince and The Art of War, that these things aren't remarkable, you know, in their own right. But the fact that he also was able to write... and also the thing to bear in mind, not just that he was able to write theatre, but theatre that was successful. Yeah. This sold really well. Lots and lots of people went to go and see The Mandrake. It was performed for, got many, many years of performance out of it, even after Machiavelli died. It was a very, very popular play. And, you know, he was quite a wit, that Machiavelli. He was always cracking jokes.
And that's a sign of intelligence. If you can make it in two different... If you can make it in some cases, it's a sign that, you know, something's going right.
Mm.
Something's going well.
Yeah, definitely.
But if you can make it in several genres, that's a sign of intelligence.
Right. And what's more as well, Machiavelli, at the time of this play, had many personal reasons for doing all of the writing that he did, because so historians and, you know, people who study this sort of thing professionally generally concur that the play was written any time between 1504 and 1518. Now, I actually think we can narrow that down a little bit more, because there are certain parts of the play that are very, very similar to a play called The Calandria, which was published in 1513. And it seems far more likely that Machiavelli saw this performed at Urbino and was perhaps inspired by it than it was that the guy who wrote Calandria just got to check in on what Machiavelli was working on, right? So actually, that would make sense. And what's more as well, we'll talk about when I read an extract, it seems that Machiavelli wrote this play as a bit of a distraction for himself as well, from the misfortune that he was currently going through after the fall of the Florentine Republic under Pierre Soderini and the Medicis coming back into power at the head of a Spanish army, and obviously that cratering Machiavelli's political career. And so he was most of his writing came from that period, of course, and The Mandrake seems to have been one of those such pieces.
I mean, you can get why he would want to do that. First of all, I think he was a kind of a man of affairs, but also a man of letters.
Mm.
So he was involved in diplomacy, unless I'm horribly misremembering.
Definitely. No, he was, yeah.
But he was involved in the Florentine Republic, as you said. And people link Machiavelli with the prince.
Mm.
And the prince is a sort of different. It isn't particularly Republican, a particularly Republican text. But then he also has Discourses on Livy, which is very Republican in several respects.
Right.
And there are several people who are saying that most probably Machiavelli was a Republican at heart. He did have this realist perspective and this, you know, cold scientific approach with respect to, you know, give me the time and a place and I'll tell you what you need to do. Maybe you have a principality, maybe you have a republic.
Mm.
But it looks like discourses of Livy is where his heart was, where his sentiments were.
Definitely.
And he was involved in the Florentine Republic. And then he had a tough time with the Medicis, I think. I think at some point he was tortured.
Yes, he was. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yes. And he was, I think he definitely had this burning desire to get involved into politics. He was a participatory spirit.
Mm.
And even when the Republic fell, he after a period, he did want to come back and say, right, it may not be my ideal thing, form of political organization, but I do want to be present and give advice to the Medicis. But what is interesting, and I've always found interesting with Machiavelli, and I won't bore you with this.
Oh, no, please.
Is that the prince is always supposed to be this handbook for how to gain power and maintain it.
Mm.
But the people he gives there as examples of, you know, how to rule.
Like Cesare Borgia.
Yeah. I think he died like 36 years old.
Yeah. In a siege.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of have to wonder whether he was actually sincere in the advice he was giving, or whether he was actually saying, right, I'm going to give terrible advice to people so they become resentful.
Well, I do think that obviously as well, Machiavelli seems to have had his own personal ambitions, right? His own personal sense of direction that he wanted to see not just Florence, but the whole of Italy move into. And obviously a lot of that was drawn up in the volatility of Italy, you know, at the end of the 15th century, at the beginning of the 16th century, with the Habsburgs preying down on them and the French armies, you know, and all sorts of betrayals that were going on. And obviously Machiavelli's looking at that. He's looking back towards antiquity and the greatness of what he saw as a Roman Republic.
Yeah.
And obviously I think that's where his Republican sympathies come from. And also just looking at wanting a united Italy, but also just to do away with unworthy rulers. Right. He's tired of watching all of these great cities being let down by mediocrities.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a very interesting discussion here, because where exactly republicanism features in the history of ideas, especially post-Reformation, is a huge question.
Mm.
And if you look at the language he uses when he talks about antiquity, it's very personal. So, for instance, in the very beginning of Discourses on Livy, he says, I think I can't wait to go back to my house and just spend a few hours at night reading about antiquity. And he was saying that reading about antiquity isn't just reading about something that will in any way will come back.
Mm-hmm.
It's reading about something that you can actually exercise in the world of today.
Yes.
But when it comes to the world of the post-Reformation, and the Reformation started a bit later.
Mm.
He was alive, but it's a bit later. It's a bit, you know, 1520 or something.
Yeah.
1517 was
towards
when
the
Luther,
very end of his life.
Yes. But Machiavelli is insanely skeptical of wealth.
Mm.
It's understandable, because in his own mind, it was the Medicis who were, in a sense, part of the downfall of the Florentine Republic and also part of corruption. And I think in the Mandrake, we do see this skepticism of wealth.
Very much so.
And what I'm saying so is that people go back to Machiavelli speaking pro-republicanism, but Machiavelli is also someone who is very much anti-wealth in some respects. He doesn't want massive, discrepancies of wealth or something. He does have, in a sense, some of the old, you know, old Cato sentiment that wealth is what destroyed the Republic ultimately.
Yeah. What you were saying as well about Machiavelli wanting to sort of rehabilitate the old Roman virtues as well and the Roman practice of doing things, that is very much reflected formally in the Mandrake as a play, because it adheres to the classical style of writing. You know, it appeals to the Aristotelian unities of time, place, and action. All of it happens within 24 hours. All of it happens within basically the same location. You don't need to have lots of changeovers and sets. And so all those things that I was actually talking about in the last Chronicles, where that Lope de Vega, the Spaniard, deconstructed those things and moved away from them. You can see here Machiavelli adhering to that old classical form quite rigidly because of his love for it and all of these sorts of things. So let's start talking about the play itself, shall we? Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I did.
Mm.
It was very funny, and I laughed. And I very rarely laugh when I very rarely laugh when I'm reading.
Mm. Yeah, I get that. Yeah,
some people are a bit more. It comes easier to them more naturally. But when I'm reading, I usually don't laugh, and I did laugh in several places.
Right. Well, that's one thing to say. It is genuinely very funny. Everything is funny about it. The premise of the play is funny. The characters themselves are funny. Machiavelli has, it's a five-act play, but actually, having said it's five-act, I'm not talking like Hamlet. It's actually quite a short play. The different scenes are very, very brief. It kind of skips along, and you can read it all in about 2 hours. So let's start talking about what happens in Machiavelli's Mandrake. So you have this young man, Calimaco, who is probably about 30, you know, he's in his early 30s, and he is Italian by birth, but he has lived for a many number of years over in Paris. And so he's been gone for a long time. And actually, he was very, very happy in Paris. He was living off of some inherited wealth, but he was med-maxing. You know, he was just sort of like kicking his feet a bit. You know, he was doing a bit of study here, a bit of work there. But, you know, he wasn't really, I think the point is that he wasn't pursuing really anything in life single-mindedly. He wasn't really intensely trying to create a career or trying to really do anything. The thing that makes Calimaco lock in is that he hears from a local Italian that this noble woman, Lucrezia, is apparently the most beautiful woman to have ever lived. You know, she is the modern Helen of Troy, you know, their contemporary Helen. And so Calimaco basically just drops everything, decides to return to Florence so that he can see this woman for himself. And then on seeing that, yeah, she's an absolute 10 out of 10, he begins to devise this entire plan to basically figure out a way to sleep with her. Yeah. That is the plot of the play.
He has noble motives.
Well, you know, he has understandable motives. He has understandable motives. The catch is, of course, that this noble lady, Lucrezia, is not single. She's married to Messer Nicia, I think that's how you pronounce it, who is a lawyer, is an educated man, and he's a total oaf, right? He's genuinely one of the dimmest men you've ever seen, right? He's dry, he's humorless, he's entirely without charisma. He's basically, I think the point that Machiavelli's trying to make is that she is wasted on him, right? She is wasted.
He goes full stupid.
Yeah, he goes full retard. And so in order to help him with all of this, Calimaco has his actual servant, Ciro, who I think is quite a nice character. You know, Machiavelli gets a lot of humour out of him, to say he's one of the more minor characters. And also, most importantly, Ligurio, who is kind of a fixer. You know, he's someone who is willing to...
He's facilitating.
Yes. Yeah, he's a facilitator.
He's
pimping for Calimaco. And the three of them are going to work together to basically trick Nicia into allowing Calimaco to sleep with his wife.
Yep.
That's the entire premise of the play. Now, one thing to say about all of this is that though the play works as a very, very raucous and, you know, immoral, let's just say it, immoral comedy, there is, I think, the way that Machiavelli portrays it, an added allegorical layer to it. And this is, I'm not the first person to have this opinion. It's one that is debated, but, you know, that has definitely been posited. I mean, interestingly enough, if I just go to my quotes section here, Peter Bondanello, who translated this particular copy that I have, he, talking about this particular thing, said, although some critics have attempted to reduce this marvelous comedy to the status of a political allegory, none of Machiavelli's contemporaries, i.e. those best qualified to notice any allegorical content, viewed the play in this light. They all considered it as an exemplary neoclassical comedy intended solely to delight without containing a political message. So they saw it as just pure apolitical comedy, you know, hearkening back to those great ancient days of Terence and Plautus and all those sorts of plays. But did you read political overlay to it?
I saw more social layers to it than political.
Mm.
Because he definitely talks about corruption and hints at corrupt institutions and corrupt people.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't give any kind of answer to questions such as, you know, what's the best form of organizations to political organization to have. So on that basis, I found it to be a much more social thing.
Mm.
He did say that, for instance, some priests are corrupt.
Yeah, he definitely did.
Or that some family members go about loving their children in a weird way.
Mm.
But I didn't see any overt political messages.
Yeah. But all of the characters in this play...
You could say there could be an implicit one in that, for instance, he could say, well, we were virtuous before, and... For him, virtue means something different to the classical notion of virtue. It doesn't have the justice part of the four cardinal virtues, but it does have identification with the republic and placing the common good of the republic above your own good as a personal, as an individual. He could be saying that, well, now that we're not a republic anymore, everyone's corrupt, even the priest.
Mm.
I don't know if he was that naive, because I don't think that in the Florentine Republic there wasn't such a thing as corruption.
No,
something. That
no, definitely not.
Very unlikely, but it's not something that it's beyond that. It's not particularly weird if he made that argument.
Mm. And well, one thing to actually say about that as well, and whether or not it's critiquing the Florentine Republic or the Medici oligarchy, is that the play itself is actually set in 1504. Mm. So it's set during the time of the Republic, though of course there are obvious reasons Machiavelli might be doing that just to distance himself from any critiques that he may have of the Medicis. And all of the characters within this play are all motivated entirely by self-interest. Entirely by self-interest. And not only are they all motivated by self-interest, there is not really any reflection from those characters or pause for thought on whether or not they should pivot or change course against what they're doing. Calimaco, outside of concern for the consequences of what should happen to him if it were to go wrong, never really has any moral question about what he's doing. As far as he's concerned, this is a beautiful woman. She's wasted on him. I am the prince, right? Calimaco kind of embodies a lot of the qualities that Machiavelli speaks about in The Prince. In that way, I think The Mandrake is kind of a dark comedy companion piece to The Prince in some ways.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from The Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.